Jeff, man, you are right. Alfred Tatum, he is so much more about than kids just meeting standards.
Yeah, I find it interesting. I think that you've probably noticed, I mean, you have kids, right? And so we know that often the focus that naturally happens, I'm not picking on things, but, you know, we have a system that's based on kids being proficient in standards.
Sure.
So therefore, we're seeking for kids to be and proficient and meet those standards, right? Isn't that what you hear about as a parent?
Right. Yeah.
And so what I appreciate Alfred does is he's trying to remind us that is that's not the goal. That's not the goal.
It's the bare minimum.
Yeah, that is the minimum.
Right.
He's trying to say we are losing something. We're losing this in terms of the gap between the minimum and what's possible. He's saying kids can do so much more as it relates to literacy, reading and writing, than they're doing now. And standards clearly are the floor to him, not the goal. Right. And I just
taking them to the heights that they should be able to go to versus just kind of accepting the checkbox activity and kind of taking the minimum.
So, exactly. Yeah. And he's taking this historical perspective, looking at black boys and what once was and what is and what he's trying to argue the way it should be. And I just think that challenge should be front and center for us. And I think his book did that for me. And I was thrilled that he joined us.
Absolutely.
So ladies and gentlemen, you're gonna enjoy this. If you have a passion specifically for literacy, and whether that's aligned to, you know, a cause or concern of African American boys or not, This perspective is a need to hear one. I loved it. I've gotten to know Alfred, and I am so glad I do. Enjoy. Ladies, gentlemen, educators, leaders, welcome to Leader Chat. I am Jeff Rose, and any second, we're going to just dig in. And I will start by telling you the why behind this discussion that we're about to have with a very talented and focused and passionate educator. Maybe a few months ago, I was invited to speak at an Alliance of Black Educators event. And it was in Alabama, and I went, and I was not the only speaker. And I don't know in which order this happened, but I remember listening to the other invited speaker, and I was really, really entrenched. I was excited. I was curious. I'm writing notes down, and it was during his talk to this group, I got on my computer and emailed one of our team members and said, we have to reach out to this gentleman ASAP because I want him on a Leader Chat, because not only is he passionate, but his topic is extremely relevant. He is an expert in this particular area. And so I am going to dive in. Today's discussion is going to be teaching advanced reading and writing to black boys in the elementary grades with Alfred Tatum. Now, here's the brief bio. This is brief. Alfred Tatum, PhD, is a professor in the School of Education at Metropolitan State University in Denver. He's a leading authority and one of the nation's prominent education scholars of African-American boys' literacy development. His research focuses on moving U.S. students to advanced levels of reading, writing, and intellect development across the academic disciplines. Tatum has authored 4 books, 4 major reading and writing programs, and 79 academic papers and publications. He authored the award-winning book, Teaching Reading to Black Adolescent Males, Closing the Achievement Gap, several others, and like I said, today we're talking about teaching black boys in the elementary grades advanced disciplinary reading and writing to secure their futures. I've read this book. We're going to talk all about it, and it's fantastic. It's dense. It's intense. I loved it. Prior to joining MSU Denver, Tatum was the dean of the College of Education at the University of Illinois in Chicago from 2013 to 2020, and directed the UIC Reading Clinic from 2007 to 2020. He led two post-release education and preparation projects for young men in intense probation with Cook County after convincing the juvenile court judges to assign the young males to the reading clinic instead of jail. I had not prepared questions on that specifically, but I'm going to ask them. So without further ado, I would love to welcome Alfred to the screen and to this discussion. From Colorado, right? It's great to see you, Alfred. Great to see you again.
Same here, Jeff, and I appreciate the invitation, and I'm looking forward to today's conversation.
Well, you know, like I said, you and I were in Alabama, and you know, you were going through data and your slides, and you know, I am one who tracks trends and interesting authors and experts in very specific areas, but the level of focus and intensity in which you delivered that was so exciting to me. So I'm really, really happy we were able to connect. So first off, without going too far into detail, maybe just tell our audience a little bit more about yourself. I mean, I read your bio. That doesn't necessarily do you justice, as you know. So tell us more. In fact, I had no idea that, you know, you had this farm until we started talking earlier today. And apparently you're a more skilled woodworker than I will ever be, etc. So just tell us about yourself so we get an idea on who Alfred is.
You know, Jeff, thank you for that. I'm just a lover of the printed word. And this goes back five decades. There has not been a word that I have not encountered that I fell in love with. And I just want to share that love with children and adults across the nation, because it's something very powerful about knowledge, identity development, reading and writing that just positions us to shape a broader humanity. And so that's been my professional work for the past 30 years. But outside of that, I'm a lover of the land. I'm a lover of nature. I am a amateur hemp farmer in Illinois. And I like to work with my hands just as much as I work with my mind.
So you said 30 years in this work or focused on this discipline. So 30 years ago, did you know, okay, this is a love of mine and I'm going to not only lean into it and study, but also clearly try to draw other people into this love as well. Did you know that, or has that evolved over time? What's been like the path?
I was a lover of mathematics. I mean, that was my favorite discipline growing up. But when I was an undergraduate, I read an article about young males failing in Chicago public schools. So it was on that day that I changed my major from finance. I wanted to be a philanthropist, make a lot of money. And I fell in love with the philanthropy. That's how I wanted to become a philanthropist. But then I read this article. I had no idea that universities had colleges of education. I was in the College of Business at the time. But I changed my major during my junior year because I wanted to go back to my community in Chicago to make sure that I positioned myself to help young boys at that time secure high levels of reading and writing. And that's how I came into the work. And subsequent to that, I started conducting research in my own classroom with four young African-American boys who did not embrace reading in the ways that I knew they should and I knew that they could.
So then you say embracing reading, you know, one thing that's interesting, and we're going to get into, it's going to be challenging for me to get too detailed. I'm going to rely on you for that as it relates to your book. I have read it and I have marked it and underlined it and so forth, and yet I'm still intimidated to try to summarize aspects of it. Really, really well done. But one theme that continued to shake me throughout reading it was that You know, it's not just about exposing students, young Black men, to literature. It's also not just focusing on them being literate. It's these, It's this intensity and this bar that you're setting for young Black boys specific to literacy that I think separates you and your perspective and your theory from others. But it is that you are pushing this bar a little bit further, maybe a lot further than what I am used to, even as an educational leader, one of, 26 years. So did I accurately summarize either your intent or how other people perceive some of your work and research?
Yeah, you did. And this is really premised on the fact that as a nation, I think we've been trapped behind the proficiency firewall. And proficiency has become our ceiling, and I advance that it should become the floor. Somehow we have surrendered the idea that kids across this nation, without regard to their economic status, that advanced levels of reading and writing belong to them. And so I began to ask the question, how do we create a focus where reading at the highest levels and writing at the highest levels is not taboo in this nation? Because there has been an unnatural acquiescence to mediocrity. And that's how I think about proficiency. But I understand why it occurs. We have so many students who are failing to meet levels of reading proficiency that has become the nation's grand challenge. And as a result of that, we start slow walking kids through school. We start slow walking them through life. And a lot of that is connected to this notion of our greatest reward would be having kids read at proficient levels. But that's a disservice to kids who are already reading at a proficient level. And so when I have students sitting side by side in the classroom, some who struggle with reading and some who do not, how do we make sure that they're well served and they can read and access knowledge across a wide range of disciplines? So it's just not literature. It's the sciences and the social sciences, because it's that social and scientific consciousness that serves as a tool of protection. And if you're not reading at advanced levels, all of that becomes sacrificed to the detriment, in my estimation, to young kids and teenagers throughout the nation.
So let's tell us about, I would, like I said, do a disservice if I tried to do this, but you can. You say advanced levels. I believe I know what you mean because after reading the book, but tell us, when you say advanced levels, I want to make sure that we're clear in what that means because of how you describe this proficiency firewall, which I think is a perfect way to describe it. A student meeting third grade literacy levels does not necessarily set them up to be the kind of intellectual you're pushing. So what does advanced mean?
I'm going to describe from two perspectives. One, if I look at how the nation defines it with the National Assessment of Educational Process, National Assessment of Education Progress, I think it's a process too.
NAEP. Yeah, it's a process as well. Yeah.
They really define it as students being able to read and write and think across multiple texts at one time, and do it at a level that indicates strong levels of comprehension. That's particularly important because as students move from the primary grades to the elementary grades to middle and high school, there is an inflation in knowledge and words. And so ideas, words, concepts are threaded, and students need to be able to navigate through those threaded concepts. That's how the nation defines advanced reading and writing. But from a historical perspective, if you look at the greatest readers and writers among us, particularly information found in their biographical or autobiographical account, there's evidence of voracious reading. There's evidence of writing to make a difference in the world. There's evidence of interdisciplinary thinking and reading and writing. There's evidence that these top readers and writers can navigate the terrain across multiple disciplines. And so I look at it from a practical standpoint from NAEP, but I also look at it from a historical perspective. And I believe that our young children in this nation deserves reading and writing that positions them to do the things that the best readers and writers are able to do historically and in our contemporary society.
Well, let me push on that a little bit and add something, because you mentioned the, you know, this practical and historical perspective, which makes tremendous sense. Also throughout the book, though, you do a very good job bringing some of your own story and perspective into, and you weave it in. So there's more here than practical and historical. There's also this personal perspective. Mm-hmm. And what you have described and your own story, but also I think some of the intellectual pursuits that you have pursued, your love of the word, your love of mathematics and so forth. Can you talk to us about how that has shaped your perspective on this need to raise the bar specifically for Black boys?
Yeah, I one of the things I failed to mention in my own biography, I've been reading 5 pounds of books per month, a minimum, since I was 11 years old.
5 pounds.
5 pounds. I don't know where that goes to the young mathematician in me.
Love it.
But I started reading these texts across all topics. And so I would read about young sleuths, detective stories, but then I would read texts about my own history as a Black boy in this station. And so I could read the autobiography of Malcolm X while I'm cozying up to mythology. And that sort of shaped my thinking that there are a lot of connections. I also fell in love talking about words. I also fell in love with words across different languages. And so when I was studying French as a seventh and eighth grade student, and eventually took a couple of French courses at the university level, I discovered more authors and how they use words across our geographic terrain. And I said, because of that, my life has tilted in a way that allows me to pay attention to our broader humanity while I'm also paying attention to some of the different knowledges that allows me to move through society in very confident ways. That's what I want for young folks. And so I frame that in this book as, how do we make sure that students have high text volume? Because there is no research that says if kids are reading and writing less, they become smarter or better readers and better writers. And so I'm sort of quantifying reading in this sense. The quality of reading and this impact is immeasurable, but there has to be a quantity that indicates that we are reading and writing and making and having experiences across a wide range of texts, across a wide range of disciplines. This morning, for example, I was reading about democracy. I was looking at data from a school district in Aspen, Colorado. I paid a little attention to a YouTube video in terms of framing a wood basement. And so I'm going across construction, democracy, and literature. And it's not even 12 o'clock in Colorado. But just imagine if that happens over a 180-day period and young people have those experiences. That means advanced levels of reading and writing becomes quite attainable and not this mystery that we have difficulty unraveling in this country.
So I want our listener and reader to know specifically about this book that this is definitely not Alfred waxing and waning philosophically on what he believes is important only, right? You will see this book is very specific relative to models, relative to how to. So there are some very pragmatic and practical applications specific to instructional strategies. And so I'm going to ask you to dig in a little bit here then, Alfred. And so your multidimensional reading model, MDRM, I hope I got that acronym. I should have written it down. Can you walk us through the intent, design, and expected outcomes of this level of instruction? And, you know, I think I told you that I did like the green tea example that was early on, and that actually painted a really, really vivid picture of this. Feel free to use that or not, but just explain the model to us, because I think that that really sets the tone for how to make this work.
Yeah. Let me start with the initial framing. I have observed students experiencing slow upticks in reading growth. And so the multidimensional reading model asked the question, how could we create or an instructional model that leads to exponential growth, moving kids as far and as fast as we can? And put this in context, I was a director of the reading clinic at the University of Illinois at Chicago at the time, working with struggling readers. But at home, my son, who was the same age as many of the students in the reading clinic, was reading at or above the 90th percentile in elementary schools. And I said, we need a model that pays attention to both ends of that academic continuum so that students are well served. And so what are the multi-dimensions that are important? One, all elementary students must have a strong concept of reading. That's part of the model. They must be able to decode words independently, and they must be able to read fluently. So those are three dimensions of the model that are what I call the Zoom zone. And then I said, students need to apply vocabulary and demonstrate their comprehension in both reading and writing while we are nurturing both intellectual development and personal development. Using Newton's model, and this goes back to my reading across disciplines, Newton said force equals mass times acceleration. So I said, what happens if I put two texts in front of elementary students and have them read and write and think across these texts every 1 hour of instruction? What will happen? So that's the force. That's exponential growth. And you mentioned an example of a green tea. And by the way, I'm a pragmatist. And so I take that initial thinking that I just described and say, what does this look like in instruction in a third, fourth, or fifth grade classroom? So one of the first lessons that I taught was on green tea. I was teaching students about green tea. And then I taught them about antioxidants. And they had to read about both of those at the same time and then write about green tea and antioxidants. And when I first did this, people were like, you can't put antioxidants in front of struggling readers. But antioxidants are found in green tea. And so now showing them how to decode that word, read fluently, and make a connection between a piece of medical text and a regular drink, it was fascinating how students could then read and write and think and make sense of antioxidants in green tea. Now, I recall a young student saying, wait a minute, elementary student, antioxidants have all of these benefits. I think I'm going to ask my mother to get me or have me drink more green tea. That was what I mean by the personal development. And so I'm focused on the reading. Decoding antioxidants, becoming smart about what's in green tea, and now this kid makes a determination of shaping his own agenda as it relates to that, and now he leaves an environment telling his parent about this big word for a fourth grader that's called antioxidants. And mom, like, where'd you get that word? It was part of today's lesson. And again, you can see if that happens regularly, in an environment where we make it difficult for young people to fail, even though we're giving them supreme challenges, the likelihood of them moving toward intellectual maturity and advanced reading and writing increases. And that's how I laid out the examples in the book that we're discussing today.
Do you think that, you know, you mentioned the big word of antioxidants and maybe some people's concern that, whoa, That's too much too fast. Maybe let's take this in baby steps. Do you think that that is one of our problems, is that we focus on these basic standards and then maybe, you know, I hate to use the word, but kind of, you know, dumb things down to a degree so that maybe students aren't as motivated as they could be by the opportunity to engage in something as challenging, but maybe something as interesting or as relevant as antioxidants for a third grader. Is that kind of what I hear you saying? Because you're clearly pushing. And I think that's important for people to know that that's what makes this really unique.
Yeah, I'm going to repeat the last thing I mentioned in terms of making it difficult for young kids to fail in our presence.
Please.
But Jeff, when I go into a classroom, I try to make young kids' heads explode.
Keep going. Tell us more.
And their heads never explode. And so there is a...
Good. By the way,
that's right. There's a tendency that if you put difficult or challenging text in front of students, that they will become despondent or they will become totally disengaged. Part of that is true. If we don't provide powerful instructional routines that gives them access to the readings at the word level, at the sentence level, and at the text level. Early in my career, I embraced the idea that all words use the same 26 letters of the alphabet. And so I just have to make sure that students have greater control of those 26 letters of the alphabet and those 44 sounds that we find. And so the word antioxidants is approached in the same way that we read the word dictionary, for example. Sound, similar relationships, looking at different word parts, but we teach it in a developmentally appropriate way that does not allow us to become accomplices to low reading achievement among our students. If we have students, if we inundate students with low levels of reading, then we're going to have the outcomes, what I refer to as the disastrous outcomes that we continue to have. Help those kids' heads explode. Do it in a loving and caring environment, and make sure that you know how to teach reading and writing that gives them not only access to the words, but access to the ideas, and in some ways, access to more powerful and substantive futures as a result of reading and writing and language serving as tools of protection.
Okay, so this is a perfect segue, and it's as if you've done this before, Alfred. So you talk in the book, and I was drawn to this section as well, on Black intellectual tradition. Can you comment on this or break this down for us? Because I think, you know, from what you just said to now, this is a perfect bridge.
One of the questions I was often asked, or I'm still asked, is how do you get Black boys to read and write this way? And when I look at our history, I said, how do you not get them to read and write? It just doesn't make sense. It's almost as if there's a genetic disposition towards high level of reading and writing. But if you look at the history, and particularly the Black male intellectual history, there's evidence of supreme reading and writing across all major disciplines. If I go back to Benjamin Banneker, for example, I mean, he was writing about architecture and geography that shaped Washington, D.C. If I look at some of the theologians from the past, they were writing about theology and democracy, about the international landscape. And I said, if we only pay attention to the historical record, we would be quite embarrassed of the projections that we place on these young boys in our classroom. Our reading and writing should not be qualitatively inferior in 2024 than it was in 1724. When you had higher levels of poverty, when you had greater resistance to education, when it was a greater challenge, I'm talking about free and compulsory schooling, which students, many of these young boys have perfect attendance, and they enter our classrooms waiting for good things to happen. And I'm saying, let's look at the historical record and how good things were happening and translate that historical record in today's society as we think about Black male chemists of the past, Black male biologists of the past, Black male sociologists of the past. There is a blueprint that we could follow, but somehow we ignore that blueprint and we're shaping a different type of literacy terrain in today's schooling.
So on the topic of writing, and you know, this is a large part of the book as well. And I'm curious, as you're looking at, of course, this historical perspective, raising the bar, do you think that the way in which our students, adults as well, are currently writing, I mean, almost like the tasks for writing right now are counterproductive to the kind of intellectual writing that you are arguing is needed and perhaps we once had? I mean, do you sometimes feel like this is an uphill battle that you're fighting as it relates to convincing people why this is important?
Yeah, there is some resistance. I'm going to give an example of I'm teaching a group of undergraduates now, and I have them document the amount of reading they do daily. And so they scribbled some down, and sometimes less than 500 words. And then I had them document the amount of daily writing. The daily writing compared to the daily reading was frightening. I have shadowed high-performing and low-performing students in high schools, going from, in some cases, 0 period to 10th period. And I wrote what they were asked to write, and I did very, very little writing. And as part of this multidimensional reading model, I say writing is the true intellectual exercise. You can fake reading, but you can't fake writing. Writing also puts students in contact with themselves, whether it's their identity, personal identity, or their academic identity. But if we turn down, going back to this notion of high volume, if we turn down the volume of writing, then we are potentially suppressing the intellect and suppressing the identity that could be buoyed by greater experiences reading and writing. Prior to this conversation, Jeff, I was mentioning to you on my land every summer, I have a Literacy and Land Institute. This past summer, I had a fifth grade student going into sixth grade. And on average, he was writing 200 words because he was reading and writing and think across multiple texts.
Okay.
Mother recently sent me and his writing artifact from the middle of sixth grade. And now he's going back to writing 30-something words. I said, wait a minute. If this student was regularly writing 200-plus words, and that was his signature, he would document the number of words that he was writing because it was his own measure of success. And now he goes back to a school environment where he's writing less than 30 words. I said, I put this in front of a group of educators, by the way, and said, is this the same student? And they did not believe that it was the same student, but it was something that happened in that writing environment that's suffocating the students are writing, and he's no longer writing and thinking across multiple texts and multiple topics. He's not at fault for that. That's something that we are in control of as educators if we embrace the significance of reading as a way to buoy writing.
You know, this may age me. I remember this was probably 20 years ago. There was these early studies on what they call 90-90-90 schools. I don't know if you remember these, right?
Yep.
Right. And when they did deep evaluations of the success of these schools, What they found was the most most common strategy and tactic was writing. Was that these schools were, as you say, writing across the curriculum. They were writing often, daily, and writing was the key tool and lever to accomplishing the success that we knew about a couple of decades ago. And I guess my last question was also hinting at, I just wonder if, not just in school, but even some of the things that we're facing environmentally as it relates to technology, the speed in which we're moving, right? The incredible inputs that we're taking in that are really pure entertainment in terms of social media, et cetera. If our emphasis, our cultural emphasis on writing is becoming less and less. And so I just wonder if there's also an argument from people, even in the world of work, of, I'm not so sure, Alfred, this is as important as it once was. Now, that's not an argument I'm making. I'm wondering if that is an argument that, if it's not voiced, is felt, even in people who are skilled enough to write, but maybe are not doing it day to day. Is this making any sense? Are you seeing some of this as it relates to some just behaviors and habits of our youth, as well as adults, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, I think from an educator perspective, it's there's a tendency to, and you know this as a leader, there's a tendency to do the things that were part of your experiences.
Yeah.
So for those who had great writing experiences, that sort of translates into this particular environment. But imagine a society without writing. In that broader context that you described, how many of us depend on, whether it's a Flipboard app or social media, someone has to shape or pin those ideas for us. So, I mean, the absence of writing becomes corrosive, not just for now, but we have to sort of record what's happening today as we begin to move forward. There is a reluctance and there is a resistance to writing. And I think it's very harmful to us as a nation. We should not become, I'm going to use this word, accomplices again. We should not, as educators, be accomplices to low volume writing or lack of writing in our society. It roughly takes about, and think about the 24-hour day cycle, it roughly takes students on average, elementary students, you can give them 30 minutes and they can pen up to 200 words in a particular environment. That accumulates over a wide period of time. Take the rest of your day, the 23 hours remaining, the 23 hours and 30 minutes to do whatever you want to do. But we have to make sure that they have those experiences, because it can foreclose, and this is how I think about it, lack of writing can foreclose economic opportunities, it can foreclose educational opportunities, but also it can foreclose a sense of who you are or the person you may never discover if you don't have a chance to sort of sit alone and think about what you want to scribble down. And so it is resistance, but it's resistance worth fighting for. But I tell you one thing, students who are in an environment where writing is highly valued, they don't resist it, they embrace it. And that's with all of the broader context that you're talking about. That's an adult. Third, fourth, and fifth graders, if you highlight the significance of writing, sixth graders, seventh graders, eighth graders, it's been part of the environment and you're sharing your writing with them, it just becomes part of that culture.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, this is maybe adults sometimes getting in the way, right, yeah, of what's possible with our youth. And I think you're right when you talk about this kind of foreclosure aspect. What, and you know, you bring this up too. It, Of course, there's this need for us to be able to be just literate, read and write and communicate. But there's also, we don't want to foreclose on this concept of, you know, the skill of writing, what that does to our thought process, as well as, let's just face it, the art of writing,
yeah.
Right? I mean, it is a beautiful art form, right? And it impacts people. I mean, it changes people. When you come across incredible, powerful writing, it changes you, right? And I think that's also important. That I sometimes worry that it's easy to your earlier point of, let's focus on writing to meet a particular standard, but also what about the art of it? Which, you know, is why I just love this concept of pushing on the intellectual side of literacy. So I want to make sure that I just double down on what I read you saying here. And you had a really great examples, not just from students, but also from writers in here, to show how powerful people's thinking can be when written well.
Yeah, I just like to co-sign what you just said, Jeff. I often communicate to students that you should be a different person at the end of your writing than you were at the beginning of your writing. And then, what are you talking about? That doesn't make sense. But when they start really thinking about putting their ideas together, they're like, oh, that's a product. And writing is a product and an artifact. But the other part of this, I'm going to speak from educational outcomes or economic outcomes. Writing also gives students privileged access to certain professions and to certain disciplines. Again, it's not incumbent upon us as educators to rob students of that privileged access. So I probably would not have earned a PhD if I did not have privileged access to this thing called writing. You know, you usually read your way into college and you usually write your way out.
Yeah, there's that dissertation hump, right?
Yeah. But you think about it, you know, most of what you have to do in these institutions or professions, you have to, particularly universities, you have to write your way out. I mean, there's no way you're going to get out of university without even with ChatGPT, even if it's fake writing, whatever, or someone else is wrong, you got to write your way out. But here's the other thing, too. Before this book, I wrote the book about textual lineages. And I know that some students have strong reading lineages. These are books or ideas that have changed their lives that allows us to have this conversation today. There's some reading for that. But when I started asking students to think about their writing lineages, many of their writing lineages were absent. That's the opportunity to write in ways that sort of shapes who you are, who you become, your vision for the world. I'm an advocate of making sure that students have strong reading lineages and writing lineages in our presence, particularly if they go from pre-K through 12. No one should leave our system without strong reading lineages and writing lineages.
So much of our content and the people that we interview were really pushing and trying to focus on leadership in the education space, right? So educational leaders. So if you're thinking right now about the, you know, what you know leaders are facing in the education world, sometimes it's very political, as you know. It's become more challenging as opposed to less, despite us maybe knowing more and having more research under our belts. But what are your thoughts for educational leaders at this juncture, specific to literacy instruction? What would you advise them on in terms of potentially strategy, motivation, or maybe even how to prioritize or emphasize? What would you want them to walk away from this conversation thinking about as it relates to, you know what, I need to consider some changes to my practice?
I'll use two words here. One, authorization, and two, exaltation.
Okay.
Authorization. If I am a leader in a district or building, I'll use a principal as an example. If I walk around every classroom and observe what's happening, ask the question, what am I authorizing in my building? Am I authorizing slow growth? Am I authorizing underperformance? Am I authorizing exponential growth? And taking those artifacts and those observations to seriously ask that question. Am I only authorizing proficient levels? What am I authorizing for my students who are already at a proficient level? That is a very concrete question that can be answered through observations. And then seeing if my voice or my leadership is leading to those authorizations that I desire or undesirable authorizations. Because that's what a leader does. You either authorize and you become a conduit to a lot of this. And so you can either be a barrier or a conduit, but all of this is going to be based on your authorizations. The word number two is exaltation. Mm-hmm. From a biblical sense, exaltation means holding someone in the highest regard. Whether it's students who live in poverty, students who are experiencing wealth at home, students who are English language learners, how are we exalting them or holding them in the highest regard as we look at reading and writing across the discipline? So you'll be able to see, are they reading text in the social sciences that says, oh, this text belongs to you? Are they reading literature that says this text belongs to you? And are they reading scientific text that says this text belongs to you? And so how are we exalting them, holding them in the highest regard across the disciplines and making it difficult to fail in their presence? If we think about these two words, authorization and exaltation, I think it's going to remove us from an unnatural acquiescence to have students underperform in our classrooms. Think about that.
Yeah, that's
acquiescence. But if I'm a leader, I'm anchoring it into those two words.
And I that's so well said. I'm actually maybe would I'm flipping in my own mind the words, right? So I think that number one, what we honor, right, and truly what we give credit to and emphasize, right, in terms of, you know, exaltation. And then two, to your point of what we authorize is based upon what we say and sometimes what we don't say, right? I mean, if we don't say certain things, we're sometimes just condoning what's occurring or what's not occurring just by remaining silent. I think so. What we honor and what we say are so important. And to your point, if we want to see a change in results, if we want to see a raising of the bar, that will not come unless it's broken down into these two very specific words and ways you say. I think that's well said. It's going to make this next question, which is our traditional final question, Alfred, because this is the one thing that we do for leaders in terms of content. The rest of our process, as it relates to our community of leaders throughout the country, is a roundtable process, right? Mm. We stole the term from my pastor, circles are better than rows. And we create these structures where leaders can tap the collective wisdom of each other if, in fact, there is this high level and focused discourse. But this is the one kind of delivering of content that we give them is through these leader chats. But if you and I were to pretend we're around a table with leaders, and you were to kind of have your final words, your drop the mic moment, and of course, you may just say ditto what I just said if you'd like, but what would you want to leave them with in terms of, you said you're a pragmatist, so what pragmatic final words of wisdom would you want to leave them with?
I'm going to start with what some people refer to as a soft word, but I think it's a hard word. And it probably reminds me of why I went into education. It's love. Love is a very, very powerful force that reminds us that we need to do everything under the sun to make sure all students under the sound of our voice benefit from our instruction, whether this is reading, writing, math, science, social, et cetera. But for the past 30 years, Jeff, I've been saying this, particularly as it relates to literacy. And this is the thing that allows me to remain steadfast. It's not just about kids' literacy development. It's about their lives. And if we forget that notion and we play around with time as if we have all the time in the world to get it right, we have real students who are surrendering their life chances before they get to know their life choices based on some of the decisions that we make in literacy classrooms.
Alfred, I know we've only talked a few times, but I really, really like you, and I really respect your perspective. I think this is good. I really want to promote this. I can't say it like you can in this book, but this concept of pushing our levels of literacy to a different level beyond proficiency, I think we need to hear more of. And I'm so glad that you're out there, not just saying it, but doing it. I mean, clearly, your life isn't just about saying, you're actually serving all the time. You're serving in your summer breaks, you know, on your farm. So I just want to thank you for this and for your time. And I know you're extremely busy, and I hope our paths cross again. Thank you so much.
Hey, this was a pleasure, Jeff. I'm glad you invited me to have this conversation.
All right. Will you be well? Ladies and gentlemen, that's what I was hoping for. Like I said, you can imagine me being in the audience, post-speaking, listening to Alfred Tatum. And it was that listening that led me to pursue this kind of conversation, which is something I just think we need to hear. Not just hear, but I hope that it promotes us as educational leaders to act. Ladies and gentlemen, educators, leaders, thank you for your noble work. Be well.